Hello, I'm Sian Kane. Before you get started with this edition of the Books Podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
Once upon a time, there was a Guardian Books podcast. And that podcast wanted to tell the best fairy tale it possibly could. Their first thought was to create a story that would touch people's hearts and give them a spring in their step, and...
What better way of looking at that than dead brides?
Oh. All right then. So, they got a cast of characters with a...
Wicked witch and the possibility of monsters actually getting you.
And an...
Old crone character.
Who was...
Taking monkey glands.
And...
Yes, working for a quango.
Which seemed a perfect start. Then they needed a location. Oh, thank you, Margaret.
They are marooned in a very beautiful house on a very beautiful island.
So what happens?
People do die, but we don't know why.
Sounds a bit dark. Although we won't be lacking in any...
fun or any contrast or any light and shade.
But they don't find it... wholly enjoyable because it's too like real life, being buried up to your neck in sand and things getting worse and worse as the day goes on.
Fortunately, the good people at the Guardian can control the ending.
The mother riding in on horseback, saving her daughter. And we thought, hang on, it's 2016, surely she should save herself.
You just don't give in and you go on struggling. You live from day to day and no story will help you.
Oh.
It's not really a story, it's just waiting to see what happens to you and managing as best you can, which doesn't sound very cheerful, but that's how it is.
Well, that's not very jolly.
We'd love a happy ending, but the world is not that fair. If there's one thing we are certain of, there'll always be...
Hello, and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast. This week we are diving headfirst into the rabbit hole of fairy tales, myths and uncompromising reality to look at what it means to live happily ever after. How possible is it to have a fairy tale ending? Well, less than ever, according to one guest on this week's podcast. She is Margaret Drabble, and her latest novel is a meditation on the dark side of longevity. As one of her novel's central characters remarks,
Fran herself is already too old to die young and too old to avoid bunions and arthritis, moles and blebs, weakening wrists, incipient but not yet treatable cataracts and encroaching weariness.
Sounds a bit like the inside story of one of the old hags from classic fairy stories. But there's another sort of unhappy ending which is being explored by this week's other guests, the cabaret group The Ruby Dolls, whose latest show, The Brides of Bluebeard, aims to exhume those unfortunate young women. This is, they tell us, the folktale Bluebeard rewired for 2016. It's about control, female transgression, and the consequences of both. With jokes. Claire had a full cast of fairy tale characters in the studio, with Margaret Drabble, the biographer, novelist, and critic who has put decades of literary expertise and life experience into her latest novel, The Dark Flood Rises. And the Ruby Dolls themselves, Jessica Settler, Susanna Fiore, Rebecca Shanks, Tara Siddle, and their pianist and musical director, Benjamin Cox. Claire began by asking what happily ever after means to the Ruby Dolls, starting with Rebecca.
I think the thing about happy ever after is that we grow up with it in fairy stories, but crucially the fairy stories always end on that line and we never find out what happens afterwards, and Cinderella and her Prince Charming may have a really rubbish time, you know. They may have horrible children, or they may not be able to have children, or who knows. So it's, for me, it's always a very troubling ending.
Jess?
Yeah, there's something about, it's very conclusive, isn't it? And that in itself is troubling, I suppose. Yeah, I think it's about choice. We certainly now, and that's what we're doing in our show, we're talking about women in 2016 choosing their endings. That's much more interesting.
Susie?
For me, I think it's an unrealistic target. If you hold that in mind and you live your life thinking, I must achieve a happily ever after, then you're kind of always going to be disappointed because it's such an unspecific term. That's going to look very different for different people. So I think it's just a little bit of an unhelpful term.
And Tara?
Yeah, happily ever after makes me think of the death of drama. And if there is no drama in life, there isn't any fun or any contrast or any light and shade. And I remember my mother talking to me about turning 60, and she looked at me and she said, I just worried her that it might just be death and decrepitude from here on in. And I was talking to her lately and she said, you know, there is something about being able to find the joy against, you know, the knowledge that you don't have a lot of time left and that this is a different phase in her life. And I think that we as young women being fed this idea of happily ever after creates enormous pressure to have the perfect sort of life.
Margaret, your new novel, The Dark Flood Rises, investigates what happens when you do have a lot of time left, even though you're over 60. What does happily ever after mean to you?
Novels used to end with happily ever after meaning marriage, but novels on the whole begin with marriage and show how downhill it goes thereafter. So I suppose happily ever after to me means, at my age, means going out on a high, not being in pain, as Samuel Beckett was very keen on, no pain, no pain. So there are many things that are happy, but not forever after.
Before we actually come to talk about the novel, let's just have a song from the Ruby Dolls, and it's called The Edible Wife, and it's an example of what happens when there is an ending, which isn't happy, and it's rather premature.
Slice me, chicken, slice me, carve me breast to thigh, marinate and spice me, and bake me in a pie. Sweetie, if you're hungry, then stew me in a pot. Spice me up with chilies, I know you like it hot.
Chop me, pumpkin, chop me, cut out my tender meat, unravel my intestines, my liver tastes so sweet. Dice me with your cleaver, and grind the pieces down. They say your brand of butchery's the best for miles around. The best for miles around.
So now let's turn to Margaret and your novel, The Dark Flood Rises, which is many things. It is an investigation of old age, as we've said, but it is also an investigation of how literature changes as you get older and what these great myths mean to people. Tell us a little bit about the story of the novel.
The novel hasn't really got a story. It's an almost plot-free novel. It's about a group of aging people in their 70s, most of them, some of them older, finding out the best way to live at the age that they've reached. So it's not really a story, it's just waiting to see what happens to you and managing as best you can, which doesn't sound very cheerful, but that's how it is.
So will you introduce us to Josephine, who is one of your central characters?
Josephine is the widow of an academic, and she is teaching an adult education class. She has been a teacher, she's writing a paper on a very minor branch of Edwardian fiction. Here she is, trying to cope with life in the modern world. She has retired, in fact, to a rather pleasant care home in Cambridge, which looks like a Cambridge college but isn't one.
She describes as meeting old age halfway.
She meets old age halfway. Unlike her friend Fran, she makes herself as comfortable as she can, but she can't be entirely comfortable because even in Athene Grange, where you can play bridge and your meals are provided and you can have drinks with your neighbours, there are some things you have to deal with by yourself. And this is just a little paragraph about the kind of things you have to deal with. This dark late afternoon in February, in her cosy, stress-free apartment, Josephine is struggling with the paperwork of her personal pension plan, having temporarily despaired of understanding how to operate her new DVD recorder. Many things are taken care of in her new life, but some problems remain stubbornly her own and stubbornly resistant to reason. The DVD recorder, for example, offers far too many options and it takes a very long time to do anything at all. It is infuriatingly slow. You switch it on and for a long time it makes no progress apart from saying, "Hello, is this progress?" The not-so-young man who delivered it had given her a quick demonstration, but she had received the impression that he didn't understand it either and was eager to get away before his incompetence was revealed. He had pointed to the return symbol and the escape symbol and told her she'd been needing those two, and then he'd run away. She'd been trying a bit of everything, jabbing at button after button, and had once or twice managed, as it were by chance, to record a programme, an episode of a Scandinavian thriller, a half hour of Gardner's World, but she could never remember what sequence had produced which result, or indeed any result, and could never confidently repeat an occasional success, and she didn't know how to delete. There must be some way of deleting, but she hadn't found it yet.
all your characters have some sort of accommodation with their old age, don't they? You've got Josephine living in her old age pension home. You've got Fran, who bats up and down the country inspecting other people's old age pension homes, doing her little bit of good for...
Yes, I mean, she's working for a quango and she loves driving herself around the countryside rather recklessly and looking to see what kind of lives other people are leading, which is actually fun. I mean, I'm with her on that going to inspect people and ask nosy questions is always fun.
And then you have another set of characters who are marooned on the Canary Islands. And as you say, they've sort of got themselves caught because they can't afford to come back to London because the Canary Islands, the values have plummeted of their houses. And in the UK, they've gone through the roof. So they're stuck.
This happens to an awful lot of people. I mean, it's happening to people right now. On the other hand, they are marooned in a very beautiful house on a very beautiful island. So this is like paradise. I mean, the Canaries have been called the Paradise Islands, the Isles of the Blessed. So this is the stepping stone to heaven, is one way of looking at where they've got to.
And there's a darker story that comes through in those Canary bits, because what they observe happening is the migrants. This is where the migrants first touch land, isn't it, when they've come from Africa. It's a stepping stone between Africa and Europe. We don't hear about what happens on the Canaries.
We used to, but what has happened since I wrote this novel is that the actual geography has shifted. When I wrote this novel, when I was going to the Canaries, I went sort of every year for 15 years, the migrants were being washed up from North Africa on the coast of the Canaries. There were some extraordinary scenes with people sitting under beach umbrellas and people being washed up alive or dead, and no one paying any attention. And I was very gripped by that and went round sort of looking at the cemeteries and so on. But in fact, the whole theatre of migration has moved eastward, eastward, eastward. It's now Italy, Lampedusa and Turkey and Greece. So the Canaries have been forgotten. And very few people are still trying to get to the Canaries, but a few are. And I look at them occasionally. I look at them on YouTube and see how they're getting on. But they've been forgotten.
But this is very much the backstory. It's sort of washing
it's around. It's a backstory, but the story is about the Dark Flood rising. That's my title. And the Dark Flood is rising in the Middle East, swamping everybody.
This is an elusive literary novel. And you're a biographer, you're a critic, as well as a novelist. And there's a huge amount of literary erudition that is brought to bear on this, not least the fact that it's partly a meditation on Samuel Beckett and particularly his play Happy Days. And readers of your previous book, The Pure Gold Baby, may spot that there is a minor character in that who is an actress who is about to play Winnie in Happy Days. And in this novel, Josephine and Fran go off to a production of Happy Days.
They do indeed. They go rather reluctantly, or Fran is reluctant, and Joe has bought the tickets and they feel they've got the tickets, they've got to go. So they go, but they don't find it wholly enjoyable because it's too like real life, being buried up to your neck in sand and things getting worse and worse as the day goes on. And then Winnie keeps saying things like, no pain, no pain. And they realise that that's all you can hope for at the end. So it's not really very happy.
No, it's the most unhappy play. But they also meditate. Part of what they do is they meditate on how the meaning has changed for them of literature. So Fran says she never really got the point of Samuel Beckett when she was younger.
Yeah, Fran is not a literary person. I mean, she reads and she goes to the theatre, but she's not. Josephine is a literary person. And Josephine is really exercised. Now, some people have really misunderstood this passage. She's teaching a course on late literature. She refuses to teach Larkin because she thinks he's too depressing, but she teaches Yeats and sort of the great poets, and she teaches, no, I don't think Beckett hasn't got round to him yet. But
Beckett was always late, even when he was early.
Absolutely so true. All Beckett is late. And he never was a young man. Of course, he always had ill health, but still, that doesn't explain it all. I don't know what explains it all. But Josephine, in these classes, of which adult education classes in Cambridge are always full of older people, I mean, you don't find 30-year-olds there, but there are moments when she thinks, what am I doing? I might as well be doing tapestry. I might as well be doing a film course, going to someone else's class instead of teaching my own. But then there are moments when they read a great poem and they're all intensely moved and together and happy. And that happens in teaching. That's good teaching, is when your class and you and all of you know where you are with a great poem. And that is sort of living happily.
And part of it is a meditation on the idea of late style, which is the thing that is often misunderstood. And late style, as formulated by Edward Said, is what happens to people in the last period of their creative life, and whether there is such a thing and what it means.
Well, there is such a thing, I think. I mean, look at Saul Bellow and Philip Roth. whose late style is very different from their early style. I mean, I think I've wandered into late style here, partly because I write so amazingly slowly now that I rewrite far more than I used to. Therefore, my subject matter has changed and my actual prose has changed a lot. I used to write so fast. I used to just spew it out. And I don't now. I write slowly. And I refine it more. And people have, I mean, Beethoven, I'm not musical myself, but Beethoven's late style. I know Adorno and Said write about it. I also am very captivated. I know Shakespeare didn't live very long, but he sure had a late style. And those late plays have always meant a lot to me. So I think a lot about what people wrote towards the end of their life. That's such a good remark about Beckett never having been young. Though he did play cricket, you know. Well, he was a very good cricketer.
Old people play cricket too.
No, he played at school and he was a good player, although his eyesight was terrible. This is one of the great paradoxes of life.
Said's conclusion was that you need to look at lateness not as harmony and resolution, but as intransigence, difficulty and unresolved contradiction, which is very much the territory that your novel is in, isn't it?
Of course, it's Yeats. I mean, the fascination of what's difficult, of just never giving in. Yeah, you just don't give in and you go on struggling and that's how you keep writing. Oh God, there's a little Yeats line that I'm trying to remember. You think it terrible that lust and rage should dance attendant... That word is wrong. You think it's something that lust and rage should dance attendant upon my old age. What else have I to spur me into song?
At that time he was taking monkey glands, wasn't he?
He was indeed, trying to live forever. Unlike me, I don't approve of monkey glands. And anyway, they didn't work for him. But he did go on writing because he was always in a rage. Rather like Saul Bellow, Philip Roth. I think women perhaps accommodate better. They're less full of rage. But I think I go on writing out of curiosity rather than rage. I don't feel rage.
I want to look a little bit at your late style. And I was really struck by a few of the way you phrase things and formulate things in this novel. For example, you have this line where you say it's not a good idea to look too closely at Ivor, who's one of the characters in the Canary Islands. He wouldn't like it, and we don't have the right to get too close to him. Fran Stubbs doesn't mind us looking into her heart. But that's quite a perverse thing for a novelist to write, isn't it? It's either perverse or it's incredibly confident, because actually the novelist's job is to get close to character.
Yeah, let's call it incredibly confident rather than perverse, because we don't approve of the omniscient novelist, so why should we disapprove of the novelist who says she's not omniscient? I mean, it's simple to me that you don't know all about some of your characters. You do know all about others of your characters. You know a lot more about Fran. I don't really know about Ivor. I mean, I know various original types of Ivor, but I don't know them from within, and I don't mind saying so. And I think that some of the readers... I think every novel is a collusion between the reader and the writer, and some readers of this book, I know, will know what Ivor was doing and thinking, because they're Ivor people. And I'm not.
But that is such a... I mean, come back to the idea of confidence. My heart sang when I read that sentence. I just thought, oh, thank goodness for that. Somebody's actually said that. I don't have to feel that everything is controlled.
Well, there are two characters, in particular Ivor and Fran's daughter Poppet. And you never really know what went on with Poppet. That's because I don't know. I mean, why would I know everything about everybody?
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
So I'm going to now bring it round to the Ruby Dolls and the idea of collusion, and particularly collusion between different storytelling modes. Tell us about this. You say your cabaret is influenced by Angela Carter. You have lots of literary influences. Mm.
Well, we do. We have many literary influences. I think we all come from different kind of educational backgrounds in the sense that some of us have a huge knowledge of plays and some of us have a kind of poetry influence and some of us love novels. And the point about the way that we went ahead with this show was to really try and fold in the kind of collective unconscious that we have now into this fairy tale. And we were hugely, hugely influenced by Angela Carter and The Bloody Chamber, and really used that as a kind of framework. But that chimed with so many other things, like Daphne du Maurier and Rebecca, this idea of the bride coming to a place and living through the nightmares of what had been there before. And we even had an old crone character, like a Mrs. Danvers parody, which was fun. And also this idea of the mad woman in the attic with Jane Eyre and Bertha living up there, and the fact that in that story, quite strangely in a way, that turns into a love story and Jane Eyre falls in love with Rochester. And if you really reread that and think about how the happily ever after, the marriage, the kind of consequences of that, that, you know, Jane, okay, is saving him. We look at that contract that these women have been through in their marriages and their lack of power. So we're really, really interested in exploring that, as in our contemporary society and amongst our friendship groups, we can see the compromise and the way in which the kind of matrices of control are played out through this idea of marriage. So what better way of looking at that than Dead Brides and Angela Carter's ambivalent feelings about this enormous patriarchal, almost mythical man?
Let's just hear a little bit more of The Edible Wife, which we heard a bit of up the top of the programme.
We're munchable, lunchable, our bones are so damn crunchable. We're hot like melted butter on a cinnamon bun.
We're edible, incredible,
our pickled brains are spreadable. Three heads
are better than one.
Chew me, honey, chew me, masticate your meat. I know you like it bloody, my tender flesh so sweet. When your stomach's rumbling, just rub me down with oil, and then we'll raise the temperature and bring me to the boil.
We're munchable, lunchable, our bones are so damn crunchable. We're hot like melted butter on a cinnamon bun.
We're edible, incredible,
our pickled brains are spreadable. Three heads
are better than one.
Lick me, honey, lick me from your fingertips. Sugar, when you taste me, it's heaven on your lips. I'm a woman with a flavour as rare as fillet steak. A bite of me is twice as rich as any chocolate cake.
Any chocolate cake. We're munchable, lunchable, our bones are so damn crunchable. We're hot like melted butter on a cinnamon bun.
We're edible, incredible,
our pickled brains are spreadable. Three heads
are better than one.
Gazzle down my juicy cheeks, douse them with your sauce. Poach my calves in muscadet, serve up the second course. Nibble on my cherry toes, whip my creamy thighs. Between them I am oyster fresh, you'll find a pearl inside. We're munchable, lunchable, our bones are so damn crunchable. We're hot like melted butter on a cinnamon bun.
Cinnamon bun.
Ooh, our pickle brains are spreadable. Better than one. Slice me.
So there we have one of the bloodier chapters of fairy stories. And you set yourself up as a feminist group. What do these stories mean to you? Rebecca?
I think one of the reasons the whole notion of the fairy tale is so important to us is that as children and as grown women, it enables us to realise and process in a way our fears and our monsters. And so we use the framework of the traditional fairy tale to illustrate and explore what we really are frightened of, which are these sort of patriarchal unseen monsters that are somehow controlling, even though we're not even aware of it all the time, they're controlling what we do on a very basic level and on a higher political level. And putting it into this fairy tale form means we can really explore it in its very darkest way, because that is the traditional form of fairy tale.
It shouldn't remain unremarked that your musical director and pianist is a man.
Indeed, and our director is a man.
Benjamin Cox. Well, welcome, Benjamin. How does it feel being in this coven of rebellious women? This monstrous regiment, no less.
Oh, it's not a monstrous regiment by any means. It's quite wonderful. I absolutely feel that the work that we're creating at the moment is very, very important. And I consider myself a feminist through and through. So, yeah. Absolutely part of the team.
I would just want to look a bit more into this thing of a fairy tale. Margaret, are fairy tales important to you? Are they important in your work?
Not terribly, no. I think maybe I reacted against everybody else doing fairy. There was a great vogue for them, and I think maybe I slightly reacted against
it. But this is really interesting, because Angela Carter is speaking to you, young generation, but maybe she doesn't speak to your generation so much.
No, I think there are older writers who've done a lot about fairy stories, but I'm not one of them.
So tell us about what it means to you, Ruby Dolls.
Jess,
we were very inspired by The Bloody Chamber. And then once we discovered that, we then charted the history of Bluebeard backwards. So we then went to the original Perrault from the 17th century. And then we were really taken this by this idea that it was time for an update. So, you know, Carter and other writers were taken, like you say, by the vogue of fairy tales in the 70s, 80s maybe. And then suddenly we thought, hang on, it's our turn now for 2016. And in every version of the tale that we'd read, there had been little revisions. So Carter famously changed the ending and had the mother riding in on horseback saving her daughter, which of course is feminist. And we thought, hang on, it's 2016, surely she should save herself. So that was our raison d'etre, if you like, for rewriting and then staging it.
Now, you mentioned Perrault, who was one of the original tellers of these stories. And I mean, a lot of the original stories are much darker anyway than the rather Baudelaireized nursery versions that we have. If there, it is possible to have a nursery version of Bluebeard.
That's a good idea. We should do that.
Yeah, I think the original folk tales, that was something also really, really interesting about this. And I think which takes it out of the realms of twee, which I think there is a danger of fairy tales being, is watching the way in which these sort of archetypal myths and stories became morality tales in the Victorian era and got smoothed down, the corners rubbed off them, when actually, you know, essentially it is a way of us all thinking about our own death in many ways. I mean, you know, the Wicked Witch and the possibility of monsters actually getting you. And I think that we want to sanitize these stories for children when we deny them that right to explore the terror of being alive.
I would add to that, actually, in that what you've got with fairy tales is something that's very familiar. It's passed down generation to generation, and through the lens of the familiar, you can, by subverting it, making little changes such as the ending, you can explore what's possible. You know, I think that's something that fairy tales give to us. They're kind of a really good canvas on which to build.
And because they're such a good canvas, they keep on getting reinvented. And
absolutely.
One of the I love the fact that one of your songs, Mad About the Bear, is sort of Patti Smith inspired. So you think, well, actually, it brings in, it's not just about the baton being passed from one novelist or storyteller to another. It also brings in musicians and things. Let's hear this particular song.
It has held the reins of power since the history books began. We'll always be a tiny pawn within its master plan. We know it owns the banks, and yet its name you'll never hear. Behind our politicians, it's the master puppeteer. It tucks away its pennies in an offshore residence, and though it's common knowledge, there will be no evidence. With regards to global GDP, it owns the lion's share. It comes in many guises, we are calling it the bear. You'll never see it photographed or caught on camera phone. It has armies in its pockets, yet it operates alone.
And when it faces trouble for some felonious capers, scandal is avoided as it bankrolls all the papers.
It basks in gilded manners while the people starve to death, accrues collateral damage as they fight with their last breath. To protect its oil interests, a war it will declare. The revolving door of power spins for each and every bear. Sweet dreams are made of this. Who am I to disagree? I travel the world and the seven seas. Everybody's looking for something. Some of them want to use you. Some of them want to get used by you. Some of them want to abuse you. Some of them want to be abused.
It holds a secret council inside of number 10. It gets away with murder, cuts out the middlemen.
From the palace to the White House, it's got the back door key. There's one behind you, Afer. It looks like you or me. It could be from the Kremlin or Italy's right wing, and it flies by private jet from North Korea to Beijing.
It loiters in Zimbabwe. It feeds on mass despair. Behind familiar faces, you'll be sure to find a bear.
Sweet dreams are made of this. Who am I to disagree? I travel the world and the seven seas. Everybody's looking for something. Sweet dreams are made of this. Who am I to
something. It winds its way amongst us, a shadow in the crowds, camouflaged in plain view, glass curtains for a shroud. We'd love a happy ending, but the world is not that fair. If there's one thing we are certain of, there'll always be a bear.
So Susie, as we said, that's connected with Patti Smith. What is your connection with Patti Smith?
I read her novel Just Kids, which is the book. Well, actually, it's not a novel. She won the National Book Award for nonfiction with it. And it's just a fantastic, moving portrait of an artist in the 60s, a female artist trying to find her way. And that punk spirit, I think, really was such an influence, certainly on myself as we were writing this piece.
So what is it that makes a good myth? I'm really interested in this question. What is it that makes a story resonate and go on through the ages? I mean, Margaret, do you have... I mean, you have actually, as you say, you have actually avoided giving us a good story in this. You've given us characters, you've given us situation.
Yeah, life isn't like a story. When I was young, I was very... I liked Grimm stories a lot, which are quite grim, but they're not really about weddings. I mean, they are about people getting killed a lot, but they're not really sort of Cinderella stories, and I like Grimm very much. I suppose I liked always a backdrop of drama and death, which does sort of tune in with the devastating fairy story. But, I mean, Bettelheim and Marina Warner both explored the sort of terrifying backdrop of the story, of the fairy story and how we need them. But in my novel, it's not like that. There is no plan at all for death. That's the truth. There is no story that resolves it. You live from day to day and no story will help you.
So there are no answers to anything, are there, in it? They talk about late style, they don't know what it is, they talk about death doesn't... Well, it does happen. Actually, there are a lot of corpses, but some of them are younger people.
People do die, but we don't know why. I think that's the position I'm in.
Might involve limpets.
Might involve limpets, yes, yes. They do eat limpets, as our ancestors did, yes.
Turning again to the Ruby Dolls, I'm very interested in the relationship between music and words. Who writes your songs? They're obviously very redolent of other people's songs. Where do they come from and how do they come?
We have found quite a collaborative way of working. So, for example, we might find a section of the story, write a lyrical proposition, perhaps somebody else refines that, perhaps somebody else comes up with a melody, and between us we kind of find a voice and a shape for each song. Benjamin over here actually writes quite a lot of the music. But it's quite collaborative, I'd say, on the whole.
So the literature, in a way, comes before even the lyrics, the idea of some sort of a construction, and then the lyrics happen and then the music comes.
Well, it sort of depends, actually. When we started this process, we did start with the music because we were lucky enough to have in the room a musical director and a director who had a musical language. So we thought about originally the themes of sort of power and sexuality. Those were the things we wanted to explore. And then we found songs that represented that. And then from that, we found Angela Carter. So I think that's why it doesn't feel like a straight adaptation for me. It feels like we went in a fully multidisciplinary way, which allows, I think, Susie's description of how we come up with the music to really exist, in that we can come at this from a words angle or a musical angle, and then the beast is built and it starts to live, and then we refine it.
So far, the songs we've concentrated on have been quite story-based, but there is one number, Possibility, which is all about this relationship between words and music. So will you give us a taste of that?
Turn, 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 push, go, slip, twist, click, twist, turn, push, go, go. Possibility. Electricity replaces my blood, a high voltage flood. I can't sleep, can't resist a peep to check it's still there. Light as air, but cold as lead. I lay my head, I try to slumber, but my mind wanders. I wake with a start, feel my racing heart, fling open the drawer to check once more that it's there. My secret affair with forbidden fruits, we're in cahoots, but the pull is too strong when you're told that it's wrong. The decision was made when the room he forbade, the room he forbade.
The time has arrived, some excuse I've contrived, to wander at night, not to wait for the light. Key in hand, queen of this land, approaching the door, the key starts to bore. You chose to transgress, you're one step from success. A hole in my heart, don't fall apart, don't fall apart.
Slip, twist, click, grip, turn.
Stand at the door, feet glued to the floor. For a second I stumble, damn key I for fumble. Steady my grip, get ready to slip. The key in the lock, the handle I clock. The anticipation, a new constellation. My re-education is too much to bear. It's too much to bear, it's too much to bear. Too much to bear, I'm lighter than
So it's a pretty bleak year and we're coming to the end of it. We've actually shown the upsides of the down, we could say. So have we changed our opinion at all in this studio about whether there is a possibility in maybe even in art of a happily ever after? Margaret?
I don't think I'm very optimistic about happily ever after. As you say, it's been a disastrous year in many ways. Who knows what next year will bring, even worse, I fear. So I'm not at all into happily ever after. Oh dear. Sorry.
And how about you?
I think we're still investigating it. I think we've, through the collaboration that we described earlier about how we work together, there's definitely hope in that.
Here at The Guardian, we are always hanging on for a happy ending. Margaret Drabble's The Dark Flood Rises is published by Canongate and is out now. And look out for the Ruby Dolls touring next year at therubydolls.com. That's all for this week. Next week, we explore memory and literature. At least, I think we do. If my memory serves me, it's with memoirist Nadia Spiegelman and award-winning young adult novelist Alex Wheatle. And I think they're talking about the memories that shaped them, I think. For more literary interviews, discussions, and live events, just search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can find us on theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or on your smartphone. Just look for us via your favourite podcast app. But for now, from me, Sian Kane, and our producer, Susanna Trezillian, they all lived happily ever after. Or did they? The end.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.